I'm speaking to this. I haven't got my print copy of the paper this week. It's an article in this week's paper, National Road to Disaster, which is again about the coup d'etat. I'm not going to exactly repeat what's in that article. I'm going to talk somewhat more skeletal way about it, and then I think there are a few side points which I'm going to need to talk about, which I didn't talk about to any great extent in the article. So my basic point is looking at the lessons which the left has drawn from the coup, and the reality is that the left's comments on lessons from the coup, the Allende regime and its collapse, and the coup d'etat of 1973, is that in reality the left has by and large not drawn lessons from it. On the one hand, the author's writing for the Morning Star, Communist Party of Britain. The story which they're telling us is, well, it didn't work this time. Okay, so this is a fucking disaster. 60,000 plus people dead. The parties of the working class substantially destroyed. Vast numbers of people imprisoned, tortured, sent into exile, and so on. And hey, it didn't work this time. And a little bit of what's the man's name? Penny Coyle, the Morning Star printed his introduction to a reprint of a set of articles by members of the Chilean Communist Party from 1979, 78. And there, some of those people are saying, well, it was the ultra lefts. The problem with the line of argument, which says it was the ultra lefts which panicked the Christian democracy, and because the ultra left panicked the Christian democracy and the army, and then that led to this terrorist action operation, is that it's perfect now perfectly clear from the documents which have trickled out step by step by step in declassification in the United States that the Nixon administration wanted the coup d'etat to take place to prevent Allende being elected. They wanted in the first place a legal coup to stop Allende being elected by using the reserve power in the Chilean Congress to where there was no, as the Chilean law then stood, the candidate who had the largest minority didn't automatically win. It had to be ratified by Chilean Congress. And yeah, scheme the CIA scheme was the Chilean Congress would elect a man of straw, and then when the man of straw would hand over to Frei, who was the retiring president, who wasn't allowed to stand under the constitution, but the interim of a couple of weeks. For anyhow, that didn't work because the Christian democracy backed Allende. Now, part of the reason why the Christian democracy backed Allende was because Allende gave very extensive constitutional guarantees at this moment as well as later, that he would play by the rules. And not only that he would play by the rules, but that he wouldn't tamper with the Constitution in any way. But as soon as Allende was elected, the United States imposed financial sanctions. It was not the case that the working class got out of control because the government was in office, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The United States government was determined that there should be no popular unity government in Chile, and that if there was a popular unity government in Chile, it was the policy of the US government that it should be overthrown by a coup. From the moment it took office. From the moment it took office. Now, in a sense, there's a question, why was that the case? In another sense, there's a question why it's not the case, but it's why that wasn't done to the Labour government in 1945, or to the various social democratic governments in continental Europe. Certainly in Italy, there was a continued use of strategy of tension and alignment of US operations, along with use extreme right, to prevent the Communist Party entering into government. In France, the US, we can't exactly say that the US backed De Gaulle's coup in 1958, because it was more autonomous than that, but that certainly the United States was not prepared to support the presence of the French Communist Party in government after the first initial stages. But he, as a general rule, in Western Europe, the United States was prepared to live with reformist governments, sometimes governments of the Christian democracy, which before pursued reformist policies. In Latin America, on the other hand, the United States had not accepted the existence of reformist governments, and there'd been a succession of coups, United States-backed coups, through the 1950s and 1960s. Now, this goes back to, there's a long history of coup d'etat as a method of changing the political regime in Latin America, which reflects, among other things, that in the 19th century, the bulk of Latin America was semi-colonies of the UK, through an alliance between the UK, through alliances between the UK and the Catholic hierarchy and the landlord class, and then you'd get liberalizing coups in which of people who wanted to be friendly to France, or alternatively, people elected who wanted to be friendly to France or to friendly to the United States, and the United Kingdom would sponsor a coup against them. So, in that sense, coups in Latin America was absolutely traditional. But as I say, the United States have been willing to allow very substantial degrees of reformism, nationalization of assets, which arguably should have passed into the hands of the United States in the way of payment for war debts in the aftermath of the Second World War. The GATT I, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade I, of I think it's 1948, allowed substantial levels of protectionism against the United States, whereas GATT II theoretically doesn't allow protectionism, but in practice allows the United States to practice protectionism against everybody else, but nobody to practice protectionism against the United States. So, and in Chile, there had been, since 1932, a constitutional regime. The ability for there to be a constitutional regime in Chile since 1932 was partly attributable to the fact that there were stronger than usual political parties. There was Christian Democracy on the left, and I cannot remember, I think it's called the Conservative Party on the right. So that a more structured two-party system gives more stability to the. But there had been a Popular Front government in the 1940s. It wasn't totally straightforward. Nonetheless, why is the United States not willing to allow reformist government in Latin America? And the answer actually to this story is the reverse. The question is, why is the United States willing to accept reformist governments in the 1950s and 60s in Western Europe? And the answer to that is perfectly straightforward, and it's Soviet tanks on the Elbe and mass communist parties in France, Italy, Greece, etc., meant that if the United States had insisted in 1940s, 1950s, early 1960s on what's now called neoliberalism, the result of that would have been to, quote, lose Europe, in the same way as there were endless recriminations in the United States after 1949 about who lost, quote, lost China to Mao. So the essence of the point simply is that the global relationship of forces, the global conditions of Cold War, led the United States to accept reforms at its own expense in the frontline states. It's actually also true of Japan in different ways and of South Korea, where the United States brutally sat on the landlord class and the old elite in order to allow modernization to take in a level at a level at which it wasn't prepared to do with the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese elite in order to create the conditions of in that in the frontline states. It should appear to be the case that the alliance with the United States appeared to be a more attractive option than alliance with the Soviet Union. Nonetheless, the United States was determined to overthrow the Chilean regime, the government of Allende. And it was in a position to do that because it could do that, partly because the government of Allende was sort of bewildered about what was going on. It found it, between 1970 and 1973, leaders of the Chilean Socialist Party and of the Chilean Communist Party continued to repeat over and over again that Chile was a country with a long culture of democratic stability, that coup d'etat was unlikely in Chile, that one of the points which Ian Birchall and Chris Harman quoted Luis Covalan in 1971, Chilean CP General Secretary. The army, quote, is not a body alien to the nation in the service of anti-national interests. It, the army as a whole, must be one to the cause of progress in Chile and not pushed to the other side of barricades. So there was a sort of non-incomprehension. Same is true, actually, of in relation to the CP and the SP. Again, we can find from the Trotskyists that the CP and the SP denounced copper workers' strikes. Perfectly understandable, because as far as the Chile after 1945 ceased to be self-sufficient in food. Because it ceased to be self-sufficient in food, it became dependent on the ability to export. Probably it was the figures I've got are only for post-1945. It may have well have happened earlier. It was exporting fertilizers in the first half of the late 19th and the first half of the 20th century. It was exporting copper on a big scale in the mid and later 20th century, and that ability to export copper was essential to the food coming in. So then the government is saying, workers, you've got to put up and work more. But of course, the reality is partly that the United States has actually abolished all the credit facilities which allow people to buy Chilean copper. So that the copper workers in striking for higher wages and to control it are not engaging in arbitrary ultra-leftism. They're simply trying to defend their interests in circumstances of massive economic disruption by the operations of the US federal government. And so in the first place, there's these two sides of it, one of which is that the Chilean leadership, because they believed in Chilean national culture and so on, and I think probably also because they thought that why on earth should it be the case that you were allowed to have reformist governments in Western Europe, or indeed in a certain sense in Japan, but you aren't allowed to have Western reformist governments in Latin America? They didn't see that that's simply there are geopolitical reasons why you're allowed to have reformist governments in Western Europe, but also secondarily that because Chile had become more deeply integrated into the international trade system than it had been earlier in the century, it was more dependent on its ability to export. That's a very important lesson for people in Britain. Britain imports 48% of the food that's consumed in this country. It runs an enormous, absolutely and utterly enormous deficit in visible trade. That visible trade is largely but not exclusively paid for by the income into this country from financial services and legal services connected with financial services. That is to say, Britain is an offshore economy and an offshore centre with a moderately large productive economy attached to it rather than the other way around. Suppose that we reach the point of, imagine that we reached the point of a Corbyn government a few years back. It's ne it would ne was never going to have happened, but imagine that we reached the point of a Corbyn government a few years back when Mike Pompeo said we will push back. The US was, in fact, already pushing back in the form of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism and the operations being run out of various security apparat disinformation operations about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. But if Corbyn had actually won a general election, the US would have pushed back in the same way that it pushed back in 1970 to wreck the British economy. Of course, actually, there's a long, remote history in the 1780s, the Dutch Republic took the wrong side as far as Britain was concerned in the War of American Independence. And the British government just put a naval blockade on Amsterdam and shut down the Amsterdam financial market and bankrupted the Dutch regime, leading to capitulation not very much later. So the idea of a socialism, a dictatorship of the proletariat in a single country in England is delusive because as soon as we got to the point of political power, and before we got to the point of political power, the level of disruption of the economy through US operations would be such that there would be no hope of retaining popular legitimacy, let alone of undermining the legitimacy of any coup attempt. This relates then to the second half of the story. So, the first half of the story was the popular unity is a stronger version of what the British Communist, the official Communist Party, the Morning Star Group, calls the Broad Democratic Alliance. What the old British Road to Socialism called the Broad Democratic Alliance. And all the Trotskyist groups make exactly this point. Yeah, this is the line. And of course, we made it endlessly. It was why we all did Chile solidarity stuff in the middle 1970s. Well, half of it was solidarity work, but then it was rather less, how shall I put it, likely that we would have any significant impact doing Chile solidarity work than it was that the British left would have some significant impact doing Irish solidarity work or solidarity work, particularly Irish solidarity work or solidarity work in relation to the continuing colonial operations of the British state, which I think I've said this before, but the British Army was only not on active operations overseas, in active military operations overseas in 1 year in the 20th century, which is the year 1968. The continued more or less open, more or less closed versions. Anyhow, so the far left did a lot of work on the Chile solidarity stuff, but not just because of personal morality and solidarity with people who were being brutalized and who we were trying to save from death or imprisonment and torture, but also because it provided an opportunity for the far left to denounce the line of the Communist Party, which is not just the line of the Morning Star's Communist Party, but there's a similar line called USA, Road to Socialism in the USA, of the CPUSA, and it said that this road to socialism, that road to socialism, the other road to socialism. Secondly, the Chilean coup had one very striking result, which was the attitude to it of the Chinese Communist Party. Nixon went to visit Beijing in 72, and in 73, the Chinese Communist Party was almost Chinese state was almost the only state not to break relations with the Pinochet regime after after the coup. What this told us was that, as far as the Chinese Communist Party was concerned, national roads to socialism meant national roads to nationalism, and that the Chinese Communist Party, because of its antagonism to the Soviet Union, had become an ally of the United States. Now, that alliance between the Chinese Communist Party and the United States has had very fundamental implications for the subsequent history, because the consequence of it is, for example, that the United States sold a lot of high tech to the Chinese government, and permitted the Chinese government to have a degree of entry into the international financial system. That has had all sorts of large implications about the rise of China and so on, which the US is now trying to cut off. But the consequence of it was, in terms of the left, was that the strategic line of Maoism, which imagined that the Chinese Communist Party was the political leadership of the international working class, as a old line Stalinism had imagined that the leadership of the CPSU was the political leadership of the international working class, lost most of its attraction. And Maoist organizations, they aren't all dead, they're still around, but massively lost weight and significance gradually over the period following 1973. What about the far left? Now, Chile had a large far left organization, the Movimiento de Izquierda Revolucionaria, MIR, 10,000 approx members in Chile. Since Chile's a country of, was at the time, a country of around 10 million, that's comparable to being an organization in Britain of around 67,000. So you're talking about serious organization. It's sort equally it's the Communist Party of Chile in as of 1968, according to US estimates, had 27,500 members. So the MIR was about a third the size of the CP. The Socialist Party, I haven't been able to find, if anybody knows of a source for figures for the numbers of the Chilean numbers of members of the Chilean Socialist Party, I would be grateful to hear it, because I haven't been able to find them. But from reading the literature around the Chilean Socialist Party, my impression is that it had fewer members and less effectively organized members than of the Chilean Communist Party. But in terms of the electoral standing, was approximately at the same. So it's probably a bit smaller than the Chilean Communist Party. But so imagine that the Socialist Workers' Party, well, imagine for the sake of argument Communist Party of Chile having 27,000 members, multiplied that by six, you're talking about party of about 180,000, and the Labour Party of 150,000, and the Socialist Workers' Party of about 67,000. Plus, of course, there's loads of other little groups of one sort and another, but none of them have the same degree of weight as the MIR, and both the majority Fourth International, the Mandelites, and the British Socialist Workers Party, and Workers' Fight, the MacGamnaite organization, which is trivial, but it's part of that general milieu. They regarded the Mir as being on their in their camp, and the Mir is an organization which, like the Argentinian Partido Revolucionario de Trabajadores, PRT, ERP, Ejército Revolucionario Popular, Revolutionary Workers' Party, Popular Revolutionary Army, was created by a regroupment of Trotskyists with left splinters of the Communist Party, influenced by Castro and the Cuban Road. And it had, like the far left in general, a commitment to extra parliamentary action, a commitment to building power on the street, building power in the factories, as opposed to electoral campaigning in parliament or electoral campaigning in the official trade union organizations, though it did engage in this activity in the course of 1972 73. The Mir gave critical support to the Allende government. It endeavoured to do a certain amount of provide military training for its own members and to engage in a certain amount of guerrilla operations. It endeavoured to do political work in the rank and file of the armed forces. But the fact it gave critical support to the Allende government reflects the fact that the Mir, precisely because the Mir had this anti-parliamentary, extra parliamentary, the orientation to the extra parliamentary, the Mir was politically had no clear, unambiguous political alternative to the Unidad Popular. This is the same phenomenon. So many of these bloody things are not new. We think of it, we forget. We forget the past, and then we do the same bloody stupid thing again. Sometimes with utterly disastrous results, which is the case of the Unidad Popular in Chile, or for that matter, of the alliance with the nationalists of the Indonesian Communist Party, who were then turned on by the nationalists and wiped out, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes with merely farcical results like Syriza in Greece. Farcical, it's not that farcical, but it's just demoralizing without so many people being killed and stuff like that. And the Mir, it's the same in this case, it's the same as the CNT, the Anarchist Trade Union formation in the Spanish Revolution, which, having a extra parliamentary and anti-parliamentary orientation, wound up giving critical support to the Republican government, which turned out to be incapable of effectively fighting against the fascists, because in Spain in the 1930s, it is possible that an unambiguous land reform project to wipe out the landlord class, together with nationalization of the banks, could have created sufficient momentum in the countryside to defeat the Franco and to break up the ranks of the Franco army. But the policy of the People's Front government was not going to do that. Okay, possible, no more than possible. But the problem, however, for the Trotskyists in relation to Chile, we have two aspects to it, one of which is this, what I've just been talking about, that the anti-parliamentarism leaves you without a political line, and then you wind up as the mayor did, giving critical support to a government which is losing all political support because it's incapable of dealing with the sabotage operations of the United States. But also, secondly, the Trotskyists imagine that if the left had followed the line of building Soviets and building organs of dual power, which you can say there are these things called cordones industriales. Cordones industriales means essentially industrial estates. And what it is shop steward combines based on the industrial estates in the outskirts, particularly of Santiago. But that's not the same thing as a Soviet of Santiago, in the same way as the Petrograd Soviet was a Soviet of the whole of the capital city. It would be as if there was not a Soviet, but a sort of mini Soviet of this industrial of southeastern Petrograd and a different, wholly different one of, and so on and so forth. So that the Socialist Workers' Party and the Trotskyists place all their faith in these organs of dual power, in spite of the fact that they aren't as yet organs of dual power. They aren't even at the level of significance of the Petrograd Soviet, which wasn't organs of, there wasn't a dual power in 1905 because there was just the Petrograd Soviet, and then people were starting to imitate the Petrograd Soviet elsewhere. There was a dual power in 1917 because having had the Petrograd Soviet and having had war mobilization committees up and down the country sponsored by the pro-war Social Democrats, the pro-war Social Democrats immediately created Soviets everywhere in the country in order to, after February, in order to find a way of mobilizing the population. That's a dual power. This in Chile was not a dual power. But secondly, what's the line of the far left? Suppose we took power, we had Soviets, we took power through an insurrection against the army. And again, this is a profound difference between 1973 and 1917, and that difference is that in 1917, the Russian army, February 1917, the Russian army refused to obey orders from its commanders to suppress the strikers. Order number one of the Petrograd Soviet is that nobody is to obey any orders which are not countersigned by the Soviet. That's the dual power. The army is split, and that split takes effect to the extent of that not it's not just the Bolshevik agitators and the railway workers refusing to move the British armored cars into Petrograd in that defeats the Kornilov rebellion in August 1917. It's also there's a whole section of the army which doesn't go along with it. It's a section of the army which seizes power in, on behalf of the its Petrograd regiments, which seizes power on behalf of the Congress of Soviets in October 1917. And it's this split army which fights the two sides of the Civil War in 1918 to 21. There is no split in, no significant split in the Chilean army in 1917. But suppose that there had been a split in the Chilean army, that there had been Soviets, that the left had taken power on this stuff, how are they going to feed the fucking country? Because it's still the case that the United States is blockading through financial and other means and sabotage operations, is blockading and disrupting the Chilean economy in order to avoid just being starved out within months. It would be immediately necessary to launch an offensive revolutionary war against Argentina and Peru. Okay, this is an illusory idea as well. And it's an illusory idea, again, because of the method of national roads to socialism. Nobody thinks about the idea that we should be trying to build solidarity across the whole of Latin America, or for that matter, just across the whole of the Southern Cone. The United States is operating Operation Condor, set out to liquidate the left across the whole of the Southern Cone of Latin America through operations organized by the United States relationships with the armed forces in those countries. United States is thinking in a continental way. The left, because it's committed to national roads to socialism, is not. And it's this very strange thing that the Trotskyists, it's a sort of tradition of the Trotskyists to say we're for world revolution, we're not for national roads. But in reality, what they propose is national roads to socialism based on the delusion you can take power in a single country, and then the nature of your power will be so attractive to everybody else in the world that the revolution will spread. It doesn't work like that. It's possible to take power and hold it as the Russians did if you're a grain exporting country in origin, a food exporting country with a very large peasantry and a relatively small working class. You have to put up with the consequences of that in terms of being having the dictatorship of the bureaucracy. But you can take and hold power in that way. But in Britain, or indeed in France or in Germany, or let alone in most of the semi-colonial countries, you cannot take and hold power in a single country. Secondly, you're going to come up against the Chilean judiciary called for a coup. The Congress called for a coup. Allende was elected president with 37% of the vote. UP never got more than a peak of 44% of the vote. The project of taking governmental office in these circumstances rested entirely on the supposition that the capitalist class would play by the rules. But then, when you start expropriating things, you are no longer playing by the rules. From the point of view of the capitalist class, and for that matter of the United States, nationalizing things is theft. Indeed, from the point of view of the guys who were running US policy in the 1970s and ever since then, excessively high taxation is theft or armed robbery. So socialism is not playing by the rules, irrespective of the fact that you say, oh, we're going to play by the rules. Doesn't matter how much you say we're going to play by the rules. You're not playing by the rules if you don't respect the right of private property. And the right of private property includes, in this context, the right to starve your workers back to work and force them to accept starvation wages and all the rest of the crap. And in this context, therefore, the question is, what are you going to say that Corvalan, I think, in it's very ambiguous what he's saying, but in 78 he says, our activity was not accompanied by the main things of persistent and sustained propaganda to give the popular movement a correct attitude to the military. But the reality is, you need to split the army. You need to split the armed forces. In order to split the armed forces, you need to campaign around constitutional issues before you take office. It's no good saying we will avoid talking about constitutional issues because they're difficult, or the masses aren't interested in them, or they aren't bread and butter, all of that stuff. And then when we form a government, the masses will learn through experience that they come up against the forces of the state. The price, 60,000 plus dead and all of the rest of that price is much too high a price to ask anybody to pay for a failed regime. And indeed, the lesson which the majority of people learned out of this is don't try and do anything radical, because the most that could be done is Gordon Brown, marginal stealth taxation and marginal redistribution at the edges under the slightly softening the neoliberal regime, which is in fact what the Chilean left since the quote restoration of democracy unquote has been doing ever since. So the two steps: one, you have to actually campaign round the constitutional issues. You have to campaign against executive presidencies. You have to campaign against judicial review of legislation, sovereign supreme courts, super majorities for impeaching judges, trial by judge alone. You have to campaign against the standing army. You have to campaign against it on the basis that these institutional forms, through the rule of law, the sale and denial of justice, and so on and so forth, amount to the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, that capital in its money form, in the form its money, commodity, production, commodity, changed commodity, increased amount of money, capital in its money form is above the law and the law is subordinate to it. That's the consequence of the institutional forms of liberal democracy. And indeed, those institutional forms are tied into the dictatorship, not merely of the domestic money supply, but the dictatorship of the world reserve currency, that is, of the United States. And Chile is a very clear example of this, but actually, there's many, many more examples of cases which are less severe, less savage than the Chilean coup. And going along with that, we have to not enter into government as a minority. In order to enter into government, we have to enter into government on the basis that there is a political majority, which is not the same thing as an electoral majority. There is a political majority in favor of the implementation of our minimum program, and the bulk of that minimum program is constitutional changes in constitutional rules, which transfer the political power from the hands of capital into the hands of the general electorate. And which, by doing so, it will be the case that if we form a government, we form a government on the basis that there is mass support for the idea that people have had enough of this bloody constitution and its institutional corruption. And that because it's mass support for that idea, then the circumstances will be such that we will split the army. Split the armed forces and create the conditions under which we can defeat any attempts at a coup. But we also have to think about, at the same time, promoting the coordinated action of the class on the continental scale and not merely a political action in a single country. And I think, let me think, I've been 45 minutes, so I'm going to leave it at that.